feel my voice kind of hoarse.
Board Game Bros.
Hello, listeners.
Hi, everybody.
It's a late episode of the Board Game Bros podcast.
Yep.
I'm Jeffrey Craig.
I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And, oh, you almost didn't finish that intro that we've been working so hard and we've been doing so well to remember
it. I just wanted to time it differently.
Okay, fair enough. So today, it is a regularly scheduled Saturday program.
Yep.
And we are talking about a particular game. For the whole episode, we're giving our thoughts on the strategy and the design of it. We're going to get into it. This is a kind of an interesting episode, a first for us, because we are talking about a legacy game.
And I know legacy games can be kind of tricky to talk about, because by their very nature, they can be subject to spoilers,
yeah.
If that makes sense. Some people don't like them to be spoiled, some people don't. That is because legacy games are games that change with each playthrough
mm-hmm.
and eventually become customized and personalized to the playgroup playing them. And a lot of these changes happen at a surprise.
Yes.
There are things that are slowly unveiled, unrevealed, you know, brought mm-hmm. to the attention of the playgroup.
Now, this game that we're talking about has less of that sort of element to it. I guess the surprise come from more of new mechanics being added, but I don't think it really changes, like, in the story. There's
not much of a story.
And there hasn't really been a twist yet, either.
Yeah.
So, and we're only halfway through the game.
About halfway through the game. Haven't finished, so we don't even know how long it's going to take.
So this is the first legacy game we've talked about, and we're going to split this discussion of the game into two episodes. The first one being this episode, and then at a later date, once we've finished playing through the legacy game in its entirety, we'll have a second episode where we can talk about how it concluded. But this one is how it started and how it's built up to the midpoint in the game.
Yeah.
And the game that we are talking about today is, of course, Charterstone.
It was designed by Jamie Stegmaier, published in 2017 by Stonemaier Games.
Yep.
And as far as awards go, it was nominated for Golden Geek Most Innovative Game, Best Strategy Game, and Game of the Year, but it didn't win those.
Fair enough.
But it's still quite an interesting game.
Sure, the competition was rough. Yeah, it is a very interesting game.
I have a fun fact that I actually heard from the man himself in response to a tweet I made to him.
Okay.
Is that a lot of his ideas for the structure and pacing of the game came from his experiences playing Risk Legacy.
Okay.
Which was pretty much the first Legacy game.
Sure. So, we've talked about another game of Jamie Stegmaier's in another episode.
Yeah.
We talked about Scythe last month. So if you're interested in more stuff about him, you can check that episode out. But this episode, we're talking about Charterstone.
Yeah.
So, Matthew, let me tell you and let me tell our listeners a little bit about what Charterstone is all about.
To where we are now.
I mean, the general story of it, the synopsis of everything we've done so far. So, in Charterstone, players are settlers sent by the Eternal King to make a second village for their people, or to establish a second village for their people. Each player starts with a plot of land and a basic building for collecting resources, and players take turns placing workers on buildings in order to collect resources, which they can then spend in order to hire assistants, build new buildings, open crates to access more building blueprints, complete quests, and obtain renown and popularity. So most actions in this game give you victory points. And the more that an action develops the game further, meaning like at least building buildings and opening crates, the more points you will get for these actions. The most important actions require that a player spends one or more of their influence tokens, which you start with 12 of each player. There's a time tracker in this game that signals the end of the game, and it progresses in two ways. It moves forward one stage after an important action is completed, like building a building. And it will also progress one stage on a player's turn when they have no influence tokens left. So it starts at one end of a tracker, and it progresses forward as objectives are completed, and then it goes much quicker once a player runs out of their influence tokens. When the timer runs out, points are scored, or points are counted, and victory is declared by the person with the most victory points. Now, this is a legacy game, so that's how a playthrough will generally go. For every 10 victory points you received in a playthrough, you receive glory points, which can be spent to add to your starting inventory. And if you lost a session, you also get points that are spent that allow you to keep more resources in between games. Because at the end of the game, you can keep some of the resources you've collected. So the losers get points that they can use to keep more resources. So there's a number, from what we know, there's a number of factors, most notably the buildings that you've constructed and the number of times that you've won, that will add to an ultimate tally of victory points at the end of the campaign, so after every session is completed. And whoever has the most victory points then is declared the mayor of the new charter and the winner of all Charterstone. So that is just a general synopsis of how the game is played. It's a worker placement game. Players maintain a plot of land that has spots where you can build buildings, and you place your workers on the buildings you've built, as well as the buildings in the center of town, to perform all these actions like building more buildings or doing other important things. So let's get into the strategy and let's describe the game in a little more detail.
Yeah, so I want to talk about the components and the physical composition of the game.
Okay.
So legacy games tend to have permanent changes made to the games. It does so through
two main ways. Yes.
Which are writing using marker, yeah, or marking things with markers, and stickers.
Mm-hmm.
There's also just opening boxes that the game comes with and adding components that way.
Yeah.
But for the most part, those are the two main ways. The buildings are stickers.
Yes.
They are hexagonal shaped that fits where the plots of land have room.
Mm-hmm.
Each player has, I want to say, 6 or 7 plots they can use.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, buildings, you start with one in play already. And on the building cards, they also have a crate with a number on it.
Yes.
And so after you build a building, you keep that card that had the sticker on it,
yeah,
because the sticker's on a card and whatever.
Yeah.
And then the crate, when you open the crate by taking the open the crate space, basically, you look at a table that shows the number of the crate you opened,
mm-hmm,
and then what card numbers and stuff you,
right,
get from
there's,
it. And
this there's is, an ordered,
for example, yeah,
there's an ordered library of cards kept inside a sealed box. Or not a sealed box, kept inside a box.
Yeah.
And yes, they all have a number identifying them. And every time you open a crate, it'll tell you which number of cards you remove from that library and add to the game. Usually you give them to the person that opened the crate. And then sometimes at the end of the game, those cards will be put into a larger pool of cards. So,
right. And sometimes there will be rules added,
yeah,
in which a card will have a sticker that goes in the rule book.
Yes.
And in some cases, when there are extra components, those are in a separate box,
mm-hmm,
like a cardboard tuck box.
Right. So you were going to give an example, I think, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, for example, I know one time I opened a crate and it said, like, cards this number through this number, and then component tuck box, like, 2 in Roman numerals.
Right.
So I got the cards, and those were my building card for the next set of buildings.
You got 2 buildings.
You get 2 buildings.
Each one had their own crate.
Yeah.
That will lead to more buildings.
I got some personal cards. There are personas, which you use one per turn. Those are like characters.
One per game.
Yeah. They're like characters that give you slight bonuses.
Yep.
And then in the tuck box, there was a pouch of little cubes.
Yes.
And then the rules card I put in said how the cubes interact with the game.
Mm-hmm. Those cubes being, there were like blights or something like that.
Yeah, like, I can't remember exactly what they're called.
Yeah, I can't remember what they're called. But they're essentially like blights, yeah, and you put them on every building at the start of the game. You collect them once you use the building for the first time, and you can spend them in specific ways.
Yeah, they're like demand, because eventually you use them to as like a resource to like solve a problem. Like when there's a fuel shortage, you use them to make candles or something.
So it's important to keep in mind how the game progresses from every playthrough.
Right.
Is that you start with these basic buildings, but as you open crates and build more buildings, it starts adding new components to the game.
Strictly
new
in
strategies
a,
and mechanics.
Specifically, every crate brings a building for the most part. Every building has a crate.
Yes.
So you go in this cycle of building crate.
Okay, so I want to say, so one thing is important in that this is a worker placement game, but it plays a little different than a traditional worker placement game. Whereas in those games, you place a worker every turn, and you can't take a spot that somebody else has taken, and once all the workers have been played, you pick them up and start over again. In this game, you can play workers on spots where other people have played their workers. However, when you do that, that worker is given back to the player for them to play somewhere else.
On their turn.
On their turn, yes. And if you don't have any workers that you can play on your turn, then you have to spend your turn retrieving your workers. It takes your entire turn to do so, so you can't do anything else for that turn. Now, this is important to keep in mind because a lot of the gameplay, especially the tempo in the game, strategy-wise, is centered around minimizing the number of times that you have to retrieve your workers, because that's a turn lost, and that's a turn that everybody else gets upon you, which they can spend collecting resources and spending those resources to get victory points.
And as the game goes on, you want to consider how you can try to get other players to give you back workers.
I was going
to
mention that. Yeah. So when you're deciding where you want to place your workers, it's good to think about placing them in a place where it's more likely that an opponent will pick it up for you, because they want to use the building too.
For example, there are six players that can be played. Mm-hmm. There's six, like, factions, six colors.
Mm-hmm.
Each one has one resource they start with that only they produce.
Yeah, it's a unique resource.
And then their next set of buildings will have ways they can spend those.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's say, like, a lot of times, especially for crates, you can use any resource to open them. So you might want to go on an opponent's space to get a resource if you have, you know, no specific one you need.
Because they're going to want to collect their own resource in order to use their own buildings.
Yeah.
Or in order, because if you want to build a building, those take specific resources. And in order to have those specific resources, you need to go to those spaces. And typically, if you're building your own buildings from your own faction, then you will need your own resource. And so taking your opponent's spaces when they're about to build buildings, or when they need to collect their resources to use their own unique buildings. Now, it should be mentioned that anyone can use any building on the board.
Right.
So you can use your opponent's buildings to collect resources and spend them, and they can use yours. And the buildings in the center are obviously accessible by
and
all.
Throughout the game, if you have any of those, like, factions that are unused by a player, every session they will get a building from the stack of unbuilt buildings into play in front of them.
Right, because this is up to six players, and there is a little bit of automation for the players that aren't playing, for the factions that are uncontrolled by a player. At the beginning of every game, they get to add a building to their charter, or to their plots of land. I think the person who goes first gets to decide where that building goes.
Yeah, because you can eventually build buildings on top of other buildings.
Right, yes.
This is important for a couple reasons. For one, you are going to end up with access to more buildings than you have room in your own plot, and you can't build them on even the inactive ones. Also, at the end of the campaign, your buildings produce victory points that count towards the overall grand winner.
Yeah, and the buildings that you start with are worth less points than buildings that you obtain later in the game through crates. So, it is a good idea when you're building buildings to consider when you want to overlap them. You can overlap them just when one building is not very useful for you. Maybe it's more useful to other people, and so you'd rather cover that up with a new building that gives you more points anyways.
Or maybe you want to cover up that just so you have room later
for
another good building.
I want to go back to the worker placement mechanic really quick, because there is one very key important strategy that you should know for the very first session that none of us knew when we played. That none of us figured out, except for our dad, who is playing with our playgroup. He figured out that you can return your own worker, because you start the game with two workers. And if you play your worker on a space, and then when your turn comes around again, you play your second worker on the same space, your first worker will come back to you. So this is a way to loop your workers. I call it shuffling. Looping works too.
Yeah.
But looping your workers is important because it doesn't waste any turns. You don't have to spend any turns to return your workers back to your supply because you've spent them both in different places and you need to spend a whole turn retrieving them.
In the first session or two is the ones where the type of resource matters the least.
Yes.
Just the quantity.
Yes. Yeah, so it's important to know that you can do that, and you should do that as much as you can in a playthrough, because taking your workers back is a wasted turn, and it sets you back a whole turn essentially against other players. Obviously, if every turn is progressing you towards getting victory points, then the player who takes the most turns wins.
It's also,
which is the player who retrieves their workers the least.
It's also especially bad towards the end of a session when a player runs out of influence tokens and the tracker keeps progressing, because your last turn after the tracker reaches the end of the track, or the thing reaches the end of the tracker, each player except for the person whose turn it is gets one additional turn.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to be taking your workers back that turn.
Right.
Because at the end of each game, each session, you track the victory points you earned and the winner gets a trophy. But for every 10 victory points you score, you get a star. And these stars you mark on the back of a box that each player has for their faction.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get enough, you will get extra resources at the start of future sessions.
Right. So
even if, like, you're not going to win, it's still worth it to try to maximize your points to the next 10 interval.
Yes, because those are very crucial.
Right.
Filling out these spaces to get extra points, because those will help you win in later games. Now, it's interesting to think about this. Because this is a legacy game, you're going to play multiple playthroughs. It's not essential that you win every time.
Right.
So we talk about how, you should shuffle your things because you should maximize your turns so that you can win. But you don't have to win necessarily.
If you lose, you actually get the ability to retain more resources in future games between sessions.
At the start of the game, after the first playthrough, you keep any resource that you have left over. That's just a rule in the game. But after every subsequent playthrough, you can only keep one of any type of resource. So there's like the material resources, like wood, clay, stone, food, stuff like that. You can only keep one of those, and not one per type, but just one of those in general. You can keep one coin, and you can keep one development card, or what is it called, actually? I think it's called an action card?
It's not actions. We call them star cards, because they have an asterisk on the back.
Yeah, they have a star on the back. So you can keep one star card. So if you lose, then you get to keep an additional one of those three
advancement
things.
Advancement card.
There we go. So you can keep one resource, one gold, and one advancement card. But if you lose, you get to increase one of those by one. So you can keep two resources or two gold. Losing can be a good thing in some cases, because it'll allow you to maintain more things, so that next session you will have a better start and you can get further ahead in that game.
I'm going to be honest. Yeah. This is probably the game where I felt the least interested in winning.
Yes.
Because it is much more fun as a player, at least for me, to just get more stuff added into the game and see how it progresses.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't care if I win at the end, because I'm having a lot of fun unveiling new stuff.
Exactly. And that says something to the design of the game.
It should also be noted. Yeah, there is a card called a guidepost after session one.
Mm-hmm.
Guideposts are...
They're like a quest.
Yeah, they're like quests. They're optional conditions that if you meet, you get an extra star at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And then you choose between Happy King or Sad King.
Right, it's sort of like pick your path thing.
Yeah, this is a morality-based choose-your-own-adventure, divergent path sort of thing. And it has light story elements,
mm-hmm.
but the main thing is that either of those will give extra points based on a criteria. And then also... whichever one gets chosen leads to the next campaign, the next session's guidepost, and also tends to add special things to the game.
Yeah.
So the big developments tend to happen in those guideposts.
Mm-hmm.
I found myself wanting to complete that and be the first one to get that more, because I find that much more interesting than winning.
Yeah, I remember the first session we ended that had a guidepost. So we finished the first session, and there was no guidepost, but then we started the second session and we had one. I remember not meeting the guidepost and not being able to decide which direction we would go. And that kind of bummed me out because you got to decide and you choose sad king.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, we should make the king happy. It made me feel bad. And so the next session, I tailored everything in my strategy around being able to choose the guidepost so that I could make the king happy. And that also led me to do a lot of interesting things. I want to talk about personas.
Okay.
So in this game, we mentioned earlier that you unlock personas by opening crates, specifically the crates for your faction. And the personas that you get will give you a special ability that allows you to obtain victory points by performing specific actions or actions specific to your faction that your faction cares about more than other factions. So, for example, my faction is the green faction. I started with the ability to collect wood as a resource. And as the games progressed now, after a couple play sessions, wood is kind of central to the different things that my faction cares about. So one of my first persona, everyone has a similar first persona. And that was just if I spend wood at a building, then I get a victory point. And one of the new buildings that I obtained early on in the game was one that I could spend wood at. And then later on, I also obtained a persona that said you get bonus victory points for using a building that you had just completed in this playthrough. And I received another one that said you receive points for completing items, which are a new mechanic added later in the game. But the idea is they all sort of center around wood in general as a resource. And I really like personas as a design element and as a gameplay element because they force you to, although now I'm talking about game design, I'll try and get back to gameplay. They force you to try new aspects of the gameplay. And from a strategy standpoint, it's good to try out different personas because those will encourage you to kind of diversify the kinds of buildings that you are creating in your town and the kind of actions that you are taking in a turn. And diversification is good because it allows you to specialize in some cases when opponents are soaking up all the resources for some other type of advancement. And it also allows you to participate in other kinds of resources with your opponents so that you can try and, you know, swap workers around, have more turns that way, or steal them away from an opponent before they're able to take advantage of one kind of action and actually be able to then capitalize on it later because you have performed it. So I like these personas. As a general rule of thumb, you should want to try and get 4 points from your persona. End of persona discussion, yeah. I guess. Do you have thoughts on
other
personas?
No, but I was going to say other general rules of thumb. So the buildings in the opening crates give you a large amount of points.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you have 12 influence tokens, and I believe one of them costs 3 tokens, one costs 4.
Yes, building a building costs 3, opening a crate costs 4.
So usually you want to be at least doing 2 of those in any combination each game.
Yes.
Building 2 buildings, opening 2 crates, crate building, which you could also then do another building if you have the points.
Each one is worth 5 points, and you know, you need at least it's every increment of 10 points is when you get a star. So at least performing each one of those once means you'll get one star.
It's also worth noting that the early tier of buildings that you unlock tend to have things you can spend your influence tokens on to get resources quicker. Yes. I would say really only use those about 2, maybe 3 times because that gives you 10 left over for the other stuff.
What I would suggest really quick with when we're talking about this is that it's oftentimes what I like to do is I will decide from the beginning how many buildings I'm going to build and how many crates I'm going to open. And I just subtract that number from my 12.
That's your allowance.
And yeah, exactly. And then what I'm left with is what I can decide to spend on popularity or using buildings that have a cost of 1 influence token.
There's 2 other scoring uses for influence tokens that we didn't mention. They're more important in the first couple sessions.
Yeah. I would say that popularity maintains its importance.
Right. So there's popularity in Cloudport.
Mm-hmm.
Popularity, there is a number of spaces on the turn tracker, or the time tracker, that has this little ship on it.
As well as some buildings.
Right. When you when you reach that, either on your turn if you advance the turn, or when you use a building that has that as an output, then you put one of your influence tokens on the popularity space.
Tracker.
Yeah.
There's a number, a limited number of spaces on the popularity tracker.
Per player.
At the end of the game, whoever has the most points on that tracker gets 10 points, which, as you know, is worth one star, which is good. Second place gets 7 points, which is nearly a star, which is good. And then third place gets 4 points, which, for getting 4 points for just at least having one influence point, that's pretty big.
Yeah.
4 points is a pretty serviceable number, incremented.
With popularity, I think, unless there's no way you can get to third, you at least want to have one token on there.
Yes, because it's just an investment that pays off pretty well.
Yeah. And then Cloudport is, you go to the Cloudport space, it takes a number of different types of resources. At the start, it takes regular resources, it takes money, or cards, the advancement cards.
Right.
And you can pay 1, 2, or 3.
Yes.
And there are different rewards for different tiers in a number of spaces. You get points for just going to the Cloudport.
You get 3 points just for using it once.
Yeah, and then, I believe,
depending on what you spend.
Yeah, on the 1 and 2 resource spaces, you can get victory points.
I believe the 1 is blank for all of them.
Okay.
And then if you're the first person to spend 2 resources, you can get a bonus victory point.
Mm-hmm.
If you're the first person to spend 3 of a resource, then you can choose between a bonus victory point or a popularity. Yes, and you're just trading in either 1, 2, or 3 of a specific kind of resource, so 1, 2, or 3 resources, 1, 2, or 3 gold.
When you use that, you take an influence token, put it on the grid of the Cloudport that shows how much you spent and what reward you're taking. Should be noted that if you take the popularity option, you have to put another influence token on the popularity.
Yes, and it covers it up so that other players can't take it. Those are good in an early play session because you don't have those other buildings where you can spend your influence tokens. If a building takes an influence token as a cost, then it will give you more resources than a regular building. Like, rather than just getting 1 wood, you would get 2 wood, or you would get a wood and a gold or something like that. So when those don't exist in early playthroughs, it's better to use the Cloudport because it's just the extra place to get bonus victory points in a gameplay, in a playthrough. But then later on, because that takes so many of your influence points and you would rather spend them on resources that can be converted into larger outcomes of victory points.
Or also, on just buildings and crates.
Yeah, plus fun. None of the personas really care about the Cloudport. So you'll be more inclined to do other things to capitalize on the bonus points from your persona rather than, you know, just going to the Cloudport for a couple points. Let's see. So
that's about all I have for strategy.
Yeah, but
One more.
Yes.
You want to end the game on your terms.
Yes.
So you want to be the first one to run out of influence points.
Or you want to be able to predict. So I'll let you finish.
Yeah, because, I mean, obviously, if the game progresses one thing down the tracker on your turn, if you run out, then that means 2 things. One, it means you can plan, if you think you can go out soon, you can plan ahead, be like, I'm gonna go out, I'm gonna try to do these before the game ends. Everybody else doesn't expect that, so they have to scramble, sort of.
Yes.
And it can put them in tight situations.
Unless you can expect it.
So, yeah, for the most part, there's a mix.
Yeah, the game will ramp up in speed closer to the ending point of the timing tracker once somebody has run out of all their influence points, because there's only maybe 16 spaces on the time tracker, maybe 12.
It depends on the player.
Depends on the number of players. I think we have 12 in our 4-player game. And so, you know, it goes pretty slowly as each player completes one building or opens one crate. But then once it gets to the point where on somebody's turn, it's always moving forward a space, that's like a signal of the end of times. And you should be way prepared for that, just so that you can maximize your workers and your points. Like you said earlier, you don't want to spend your last turns retrieving your workers from the board. You want to be productive up to the very end.
It's also worth noting that since popularity can be gained if you advance the tracker on your turn, if you're doing that on your turn, even if you have no influence tokens left, that means that you've robbed other players of that option.
True, yes. So let's get into the design.
Yeah.
There's a lot we'd like to talk about. First, and the first thing that should be noted is that this game was designed to be a legacy game. So right. up until now, we've mentioned a couple different legacy games, but it's usually it's the games that have been designed are a legacy version of an existing game.
The two main ones were Risk Legacy, which is the first one.
Which is obviously Risk, but made into a legacy
game. And then Pandemic Legacy, which is obviously Pandemic, made into a legacy game.
Exactly.
There's been other games since those that have been unique legacy games, like Seafall is one. However, this is the one we're talking about.
Yes, so Charterstone, yes, it was designed to be a legacy game. There was no Charterstone before this that was not a legacy game.
Designed from the ground up.
So a lot of the things put into the game lend themselves to being a legacy game, and it makes the game way more ingestible than or digestible, I guess, than like Pandemic Legacy or Risk Legacy.
I was surprised how simple the first session was.
Yes,
it was kind of barren.
It's amazingly simple because there's one thing that the game does is that you start with the basic resource spaces, buildings in your charters, and nothing else. And you have some more buildings that you can build available to you from the beginning of the game, and they do not have specific resource costs. So you can use your own resource to do, or you can use any resource to build them, and obviously you should be doing that resource shuffling that I mentioned to just collect resources without wasting any turns. But yeah, it starts out that basic, and then it introduces you, after you build new buildings, it introduces the fact that they take specific, you don't start with extra buildings, you just start with the crate.
Yeah.
That's right. And you open the crate, and then the crate will tell you that you need specific resources. And the crate takes any kind of resource. Anyways, what I'm saying is, it starts very basic, to the point where it doesn't even matter what kinds of resources you're using.
Yeah. Also, the Charterstone is a unique legacy game in that it is designed to be replayable at the end of the campaign, not through the campaign again. Mm-hmm. It's designed so that at the end of the campaign, your playgroup has a unique, reusable worker placement game made up of all the decisions made through the game of Charterstone.
Right.
And so much of the game's like sort of design is about the evolution from that very starting simple game to the end product.
Right, because, I mean, the goal of the game is to just be the mayor of the town that you have finished.
Yeah.
And once you're finished, you still have the town, and you can still use it to play the game, which is interesting.
But luckily, like, I think the thing that's really cool is that it's much more fun to open the crates and build the buildings and uncover new stuff as it goes. And that's sort of the first thing I want to talk about in terms of design, is how it uses player psychology to pace the game. So, like we said, the game starts with one building, and then you have the crate from that building being built.
Yes.
So, when you look at what gives you the most points, it is the building a building and the opening a crate. So, usually, like, player will get to open the crate soon, and then that will, you know, make them open the crate. And it's also important that, like, the cloud port you can go to early, but it runs out of spots pretty quickly, and if people realize it's not doing that great of a point, you know, value, then they're kind of naturally drawn strategically to the Charterstone is where you open the crates.
Yeah. Also, in the first playthrough, the only way to get influence, I mean, to get popularity, is through the three spaces on the cloud port.
Right.
And so after that has been taken up, then there's no way to get influence, which, I mean, popularity is also a very high point reward.
Yeah.
But it's limited in the first playthrough, and to the point where it's almost ignored.
And also, the first session's kind of slow paced, so people might want to end it sooner. Which means if they're going to spend more influence tokens, they have to go to the place that spends the most, which is the Charterstone.
Yes.
So it naturally draws the player to opening the crate without telling them to open the crate. So you open the crate, and then you get two buildings, you get some extra stuff.
You get your first persona.
You get your first persona. And I think at that point, the player has an epiphany where they realize that the crates are really big. They let you do cool stuff. They let you do more stuff.
Yeah.
And so it really quickly, naturally tells the player that crates are important and they make big changes. And it introduces the player to that excitement and tension of opening a crate and not knowing what's going to come out, digging through the box of cards like a treasure chest.
I think it's cool that you get to do that in the middle of a game.
Yeah.
Because in other legacy games, like Pandemic, you don't make the major modifications to the game until the end of a session. So you'll start a session, or it either happens at the start or the end. You'll start a session and maybe like the virus will mutate a little bit.
The story will progress.
And then you'll end the session and you'll get to like upgrade all of your personas in that game, and you'll mutate the virus further and you'll uncover the next
quest. You know what's funny is in Pandemic Legacy, the things that happen during the game are all bad. The permanent changes.
Yeah, in this game, all the stuff that happens to the game will almost always happen in the middle of the game after you've opened a crate, and it's always exciting because it adds more stuff
to
the game.
Even though it interrupts the play flow, it's exciting. Every player is sitting around just wondering what's going
to
come out.
It's also cool that once you open a crate, if it adds a new mechanic to the game, it immediately gives you a part of that mechanic.
Yeah.
So once we opened a crate and we added
items,
the person who opened the crate received an item. So they got to play with it right there. Like they didn't have to waste any turns.
And it's also worth noting that it gives you a trial run of it.
Yeah.
So you can get how it works. It also rewards the player for opening the crate because they are the first one to get those benefits for...
Oftentimes, too, the persona that comes in a crate that comes with a new mechanic, that persona gets special bonuses for utilizing that new mechanic. And so it's like another example how you said that it gives you a trial run. It also gives you a trial run so that in the next playthrough you can decide to use that persona on that
mechanic. If you want to make that a more important strategy.
Yes. It's very good. And, I mean, the mechanics that they add are generally simple, and they play off of existing ideas. So, or they just utilize some mechanics that have been in the game for a while now. So, for example, the items are their advancement cards that you obtain from the advancement card trade row, which everyone has access to during the game, and it just costs a gold to obtain a card from there. Through the market, which is a specific building. So you go to a building, you pay a gold, you get a card from the trade row. And the item cards are, they just have a resource requirement, just like your buildings. And usually it requires two of a specific resource and then one of a other resource or something like that. Maybe two and then two other resources. Either way, it follows a similar track of thought that building has. So you kind of get exactly how long it'll take you to score an item card and get points. And of course the person who goes first gets an item right away that they get to try and finish for points.
Yeah. Let's see. So, talking about opening crates, the game campaign seems to be paced around opening crates in specific intervals.
Mm-hmm.
We mentioned typically every player will open one a session, one to two maybe. But also, the crates don't always give you a huge difference. In fact, I think we found that the biggest mechanical changes came at the third tier of buildings.
Yes.
So your first building is your first tier, and second two buildings are second tier.
And the second two buildings are usually just the buildings that allow you to spend a influence point to get bonus resources, or a building that allows you to spend one of your faction's resources in order to get a bonus effect.
Yeah. And so with that in mind, if everybody's opening one crate a game, that might take you to session three to really get the new mechanics that are new ideas.
Yep.
That means that every player pretty much has two sessions to understand the core game.
Yeah.
So that's really good. You don't want to throw a lot at the players at once.
Yep.
Especially in this game where the sort of goal is to throw stuff at the players constantly.
Mm-hmm.
You want to give them some time to, test the waters.
Right. So, in your third session, you'll be unlocking new mechanics. And then the fourth tier of building. So, if the first tier is resources, the second tier is more resources or clever use of resources. The third tier is new mechanics. The fourth tier is ways to use the new mechanics.
Right.
So, it's like ways to spend items to do other kinds of things.
It's expanding on the new thing you just learned, yes. But not immediately.
Or if it adds a new mechanic, it's not adding new pieces to the game. It's just a new thing you can do with right. your existing pieces.
It's sort of like a puzzle game where it makes sure the player understands an idea and then tests it with new concepts.
Mm-hmm. So, now, I think something that's interesting about this game's design is that you can use a new persona every game, but you don't have to. If any, you can always have the option of just sticking with a strategy and doing it over and over again, and it can work to a degree. Now, if that strategy doesn't involve building buildings and opening crates, then you're not going to be able to have more options later in the game, and you're also not going to have more impressive buildings in your own charter for to count as victory points at the end of the game. But it's still interesting that, like, you know, I forced myself to try new strategies and to explore new personas, but I had a decent strategy in our second playthrough that I probably could have run through for a few more sessions to good success.
It's also interesting that your first persona is always when you spend your resource, you gain a point.
Mm-hmm.
But as it goes on, some of the personas don't even do points. They do how you use resources and efficiency. Like, I had one that was you may spend gold as if it were resources.
Yes. Although your character was somewhat of an alchemist.
Right.
Yes,
it was the alchemist that, persona.
That typically the personas don't... they typically give you bonus victory points for doing specific things, but... You know, some and personas do other things.
That one synergized with the building I had, which was pay a coal, gain 2 gold.
Yes. Yeah, my personas all involved gaining bonus points for doing things that involved wood.
Yeah.
Or that were, you know, central to my mm-hmm. character.
Yeah, and also, so with Charterstone, there are sort of three main points of the game that are being developed over time.
Mm-hmm.
There is characters... players, I guess, buildings and the board in general, and there is the game mechanics. So players, game, board.
Yeah.
And the crate building cycle makes sure that you're always updating two of those, typically, which are mechanics and board.
Mm-hmm.
And the session sort of structure makes sure players are being updated with the stars and the losing and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
So the game, there's like this natural way that it just makes sure that every part of the game is being furthered. You're not getting a lot of mechanics, but no buildings. You're not getting a ton of buildings, but nothing new happening.
Mm-hmm. Now, one thing I also like about this game so far is that we are getting more points per session.
Yeah.
But it's not very many.
Yeah.
So, which
it's
is
like
good.
4 or 5 a
it's
session.
It's good how it's been paced that way because... You don't want players to fall too far behind in their glory acquisition, which is the stars that you get for every increment of 10 points. But you do want it to be shown that as the game has progressed and you've unlocked more buildings, you have the potential to get more points in a session with your 12 influence cubes.
You know, so, speaking of influence...
Hold on, let me finish this thought, and then we'll bring that up, because I think I know what you're going to talk about. But, yeah, we started around the 30 to 40 point range in our first sessions, and now that we're on the fourth set, we just finished our fourth session, I think we finished with somewhere between 50 and 60 points, I think. Somewhere around there, because it's like, so we finished somewhere around 50 and 60 points at the top end, and the back end was like somewhere between 40 and 50. It's increasing, but it's only by the difference of like 1 or 2 glory, so it's not a huge difference, which is good.
What's cool about that also is with the glory, there are more things you can get at the start of a game than are even in the game at the first session.
Yeah.
There are resources that don't appear till later, but that makes sense if you are only getting so much glory and then later on, like, session 4, you're starting to get a lot more per game. Because, you know, at the start, you might just be interested in the resource or the gold, and only later do you have the stars to even really consider the other ones, which
right.
you don't
it's
even
like,
know what they are.
It's like if you had too much glory to start with, then you wouldn't know what to do with it.
Because
you'd fill up the resource and gold tracker, and then you'd be like, well, I don't know what the rest of this stuff means, so why should I care about it?
It also makes sense, because if people start getting multiple new mechanics and resources added about game 4, session 4... then that's when you should get more stars to get those resources.
Mm-hmm.
So what I was going to say about influence is on our most recent session, we actually had buildings that can regain influence for you.
Yes.
And that is something that's really cool, that so the first couple sessions are slow influence spending, and then faster and faster as you get better production and open more crates and stuff.
Because we want to use more of the spaces that give us extra resources at the cost of influence, because that lets us open our crates faster and build our buildings faster.
Now we have both the ability to cover up buildings that require influence, and we have ways to get them back, so it ebbs out in like this wave of slow pace, fast paced, breather pace, fast paced.
Yeah.
We'll have to see how that progresses.
Yes, I think. I'm interested to see this, because even if you return influence, that doesn't necessarily mean that other people are doing it too.
Right.
Which means that other people could just spend their influence crazy fast and end the game quickly.
True.
To the point where you returning your influence has little effect on your end. On the points that you've earned at the end of the game. So it'll be interesting to see how much our playgroup values returning influence points to perform other tasks. Because if we all value it, then that will lead to some interesting games where we get a large amount of progression with regards to building buildings and opening crates.
And managing influence becomes much more important as a mechanic.
Yes, but it's less important to budget because of how much it costs to open crates and build buildings. We've also built buildings now that allow us to build for less numbers of influence points.
Right.
So it's interesting. Now that we've grown accustomed to how quickly a game can end and how many influence points it costs to do one thing or another, the game is allowing us to be more creative with that.
I think that's cool that it doesn't provide you those options until you understand how the game's normally paced and why those options are big.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so that was a lot about pacing and how it gets players to do that. Guideposts, I also want to bring up.
Guideposts are interesting because they don't necessarily always go to whoever wins.
Right.
Because the guidepost, let's see, the three that we've encountered so far, it was the person with the most buildings was one of them.
Person with the most gold.
The person with the most gold. And then the person with the fewest quests.
Yeah.
And then, so at least in the case of fewest quests, that doesn't all go to the person in first, usually. Because quests will give you victory points. Quests are just cards at the beginning of the game that if you meet a requirement and go to a building called the Bandstand, you will score...
Grandstand.
You will score 5 points, and it costs an influence piece to do so. That also will progress the turn tracker. So the person with the least quest doesn't necessarily lend itself to somebody who won. Anyone has a chance of obtaining this. Now, if there's a tie for the grandstand when it comes down to who decides which outcome to go with versus with between the happy king and the sad king, it goes to the person with the most influence tokens left over at the end of the game.
And then if there's a tie, you roll a die.
Yes. But what that means is that a person, now generally, the person who's completed the guidepost doesn't necessarily have to be the person first, but the person with the fewest influence tokens in general is probably going to be closer to last place than a person in first place. So in that case, it will oftentimes go to somebody who's a little behind in the game who gets to choose the guidepost, which is very cool.
So what the new guidepost gives you, other than the next part of the story and the guidepost for the next game, it gives you mainly rules changes that need to be done. Mm-hmm. So like we mentioned how you retain all your resources the first game, and then second game at the end you have to get rid of most of them. Mm-hmm. That's done through the guidepost. But also it seems like the most major general changes are reserved for guidepost. So this is, I think, sort of a spoiler, but there are sky islands now.
Yes.
And for one thing, they were hidden in the box, which I thought was funny.
Yeah, they were underneath obstructive. They were basically in a false bottom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you can build buildings on them, and they're optional, interchangeable, whatever. But everybody got them, and those came from a guidepost that we just got. So, I think I'm expecting this to happen, that most of the very large, core mechanic changes happen there. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's another good way of, they can take the changes they want to make that they want to happen at a specific session without any room for players to do it at a different time. And they put those there.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you're making a legacy game like this where you want to have changes happen every session and you don't want players to be the ones who determine when they happen precisely, it's a good idea to have that sort of thing. And even like make it still like a fun interactive thing, because like Pandemic Legacy had just a deck of cards that you flip over until it says stop.
Mm-hmm.
The guideposts are fun because they're interactive. They offer some fun things players can do.
They offer a side quest.
Yeah.
That's aside from having the most mm-hmm. victory points.
They yeah. give you a thing you can do with instead of winning.
And it's interesting that the designer was able to choose between whether or not a addition and an advancement in the game goes in a crate or whether it goes on a guidepost. And putting the sky islands on the guidepost, which are essentially how they work, is you can put buildings on sky islands, and then you can have them cover up other buildings in your plot of land temporarily for a session of the game. So it allows you to have more buildings than you have space for in your initial plot, but you can't have access to all of them. You have to cover one up with an island if you want to use it.
That ties into the victory points at the end of the campaign.
Right. But I like that that's kind of a more complicated thing than just adding like
new hires, like
adventurers to the game that you can just hire and then collect resources from at different intervals. Yeah, it's more advanced to have to think about when you're going to use the Sky Islands. What you're going to build on them so that you can change it out depending on your strategies and stuff like that.
I was surprised. The new worker mechanic, we first got it through one of the player-specific crates.
Yes.
So that's an example of a big one that is reserved for that.
The new worker?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I have one more design I want to bring up before we end this, and that is hooks.
Okay.
So, Charterstone is a game. As all legacy games, it requires an amount of commitment from the players. And one way to make players want to commit early on, instead of giving them leeway to, like, drop out, they do this with hooks. So we mentioned how on the back of the box where you put your stars, there are more resources than you know what they are.
Yeah.
You don't know what some of them are. That's an example of a hook, where a player might see that and they really want to know what it is. And if the only way to do that is to keep playing, it draws them in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of a rabbit hole sort of thing where like it teases at things in the game, or like the time tracker has an income space. You don't know what that does until you get buildings that care about income.
Mm-hmm.
And then you know what it does. But like until then, you really want to know what it is. It's there. It's intriguing. And then, you know, you figure it out.
So there's,
and I think,
there's the thing normally, where the islands were in the bottom of the box. We didn't know they were there. So that was a big surprise. That was very cool. But mm-hmm. then there's also this thing where you can hint at future advancements in the game.
While it could be a problem to make players feel like they forgot something or that they don't know what something is, it might feel like stressful to have to think about it. But like,
it's curious.
Yeah, it's curious, and I think in this case it works. If it was a standalone game, it wouldn't be as cool.
Mm-hmm.
If, like, there was something on the board that hinted at a thing that gets added later in that single game,
mm-hmm.
and you didn't know what it was.
So you're saying if it wasn't a legacy game?
If it wasn't a legacy game, but a game that introduced something
in the middle. That's the thing with a legacy game, and maybe it could be part of the rule book. I think this, mm-hmm. I don't know if it does it in Charterstone, but I think this is something that happens at least with a more casual play group like ours, mm-hmm. and that is these things will oftentimes, people will be like, well, what's that?
And it's like, and we don't know.
Essentially, yes, you have to have that kind of mindset going into a legacy game when you're playing it, that you have to say, I don't know what it is. It will eventually tell us, and we just have to be patient and be okay with not knowing
what something is. A game that I know I've played that I think has that and it doesn't help as much is Betrayal at the House on the Hill.
Okay.
That's a game that introduces new mechanics later on and has things that refer to them that you can get early in the game.
Mm-hmm.
But in that case, it's just kind of it's kind of confusing, yeah.
Yeah.
In this case, since the game is all about uncovering new things, and you kind of go into it with that expectation.
Yeah, you get used to it.
Yeah, you get used to it, and then you get interested.
Right. I wanted to say one more thing about the design of this game, and that is with regards to being dedicated to one specific faction in the game. So when we started, we didn't know anything about what the factions did individually, how your faction was about creative use of resources as some sort of alchemist, as well as being dedicated to the coal resource, how mine was about using the wood resource and caring about building buildings and completing items. We didn't know any of that going in. We just picked our factions based on the color that went along with them. They have a little bit of a clue.
Actually, it was more so where we sat down at the table.
Yes,
you do have to sit. Players are in order. Yeah,
yeah, you do have to sit in the order that your faction appears.
Something that Jamie Stegmaier likes, I guess.
Yes, but oh yeah, because it does that in Scythe too. Yeah. But so you have to dedicate yourself to this one specific thing, and that can feel bad sometimes, kind of like when you start a role-playing game and then you don't like the class that you picked for yourself and you want to make a new character. You can't do that in this game because you're making you make a permanent change to the game right from the beginning. And at least maybe it's very difficult and you have to be very fiddly and
lenient the thing is, in order to do that. The permanent changes in this game in session one aren't that big.
Well, that's what I'm saying is that this game handles it well because really the only difference between any faction is just the personas you get. And the personas only serve to encourage you to do one thing that your faction does better than other people, but not very much better. To the point where, I mean, the strategies can be very generic and
homogenized.
I mean, not homogenized, but I mean, like, you can use other people's buildings, which plays a big part in that. Like,
no, you can choose build to do other people's kinds of buildings.
Yes, you can build other people's buildings. Like, at the end of a session, if you have too many buildings left over that you didn't build, you have to give some of them back to the supply.
And then they go in the advancement deck.
And then you can buy them later and build them later
other sessions. That's how Unused Plots gets building, is they get them from that advancement deck.
So essentially, you, Matthew, might have a building that you didn't build in your in a session that goes into the advancement deck. I can buy it later and build it in my plot. So there's flexibility is what I'm trying to get to between the different factions, to the point where one faction isn't going to have such a unique identity that, you know, it won't be able to do other things. It'll have to just be itself and you won't be able to try new things in the game. But it's also, I mean, the way that you slowly get these personas and they each have like a new way of focusing on a different thing in the game and they reward you for it. That rewarding feeling from doing new interesting things is kind of a way to sort of make you gain an affinity for your class and kind of become loyal to it or kind of grow to like it. Especially all the classes also start the same. Even their first persona is generally the same thing for every person, where it doesn't really matter exactly what it does. It's just about the same thing. So it is kind of like they don't really lock you into specific flavor of strategy until much later, to the point where you're like, oh, I actually kind of like my persona.
In a way, I think it's kind of funny because the main difference between them after that is the speed at which they unlock their own crate and then their own mechanics that get added from their crates. I think that almost gives it replay value. If I were to play with a different group, I would intentionally choose a different faction, one of the ones that we don't have a player for in our group, because then I'd be able to get to theirs quicker and it would play out differently the rest of the campaign.
But you're satisfied with the one that you have in this game because it gets good at doing what it does and you like doing what it does. Also, you get to name everything in the game. Because it's a legacy game, a big part of the game is that you get to name things and write it down in Sharpie. So you get to name your character that represents your faction.
You get to name like NPC helper characters.
Yeah, assistants that you acquire.
You name your village.
You name the village. I won the very first playthrough, so I got to name the unnamed plots on the whole village. And then after a couple sessions, you get to name the entire charter as a whole. And you do that as a group, which is nice.
It's a very, very unique game.
It's a unique game. It does a lot of stuff well to help introduce you to things in a legacy game, to introduce you to things in its own game. And it's fun.
The first session might be really slow, but if you can power after that, you'll really enjoy it if you like other engine games.
Yeah, and it does pick up a little quickly at first. Like, when you start adding the new buildings and the new mechanics, it kind of introduces them rapidly. But I think that also kind of serves to slow down later sessions while you try and figure out which ones you kind of want to do, which is okay.
Okay. Yeah.
Similar games as other legacy games.
Other legacy games, based other, on the, yeah, other engine building games. I'm just going to say Food Chain Magnate.
I'm going to say Champions of Midgard.
Sure.
Yeah.
But Scythe.
In Scythe. Yeah,
Euphoria, other, too.
Sure. So, that is the end of our Charterstone episode.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to part one.
Yeah.
Part two isn't coming up next week because we still have to play through... You know,
at least just four, maybe
maybe even more
yeah.
Sessions to finish the actual game. So that episode will come at a later date. We'll just talk about a different game next week and the following weeks until we're done. But that was part one of our two-part Charterstone.
Thank you for listening.
If you want to, you can follow us and follow everything we do on our social media at BG Bros Cast. You can also find our website at bgbcast.com, where we post all our episodes and tag them all for you to search for different kinds of games that you want to hear us talk about. And if you're also interested in checking out websites that we give you the URL for, you can always go to entertainthegeeky.com, where our friends Chris and Roger and Jason host their own podcasts, as well as have a an e-shop where you can buy merch.
You can buy our merch. We're going to have shirts coming soon.
Yes, we're going to have shirts coming soon. And you can also purchase our one-page role-playing game, Merle's Truck Stop in Maine, there. It's $5, but you can get it for free right now if you use promo code Geeky.
G-E-E-K-Y.
Use promo code Geeky at checkout.
Since I've tried to come up with a funny campaign, run you can do based on the month, I'm going to say in June, make a Killer Shark one-shot.
A Killer Shark?
Yeah.
Why is that?
I don't know. June, summer, Killer Shark, Jaws, Stephen King, whatever. I don't know.
Okay, I'm thinking more it's dads and grad season.
Oh, so, sure.
Maybe make a campaign about a dad that has to kill a grad.
Or it could be dad and grad going hunting.
Oh, yeah. You could play one person as a dad, one person as a grad.
It's like a Sasquatch.
Grad, and then they come across a terrible horror. Yeah, perfect for the month of June.
Yeah, either way.
Promo code Geeky at checkout for free. And take pay attention to what's going on their website and our social media and our website with information regarding our Kickstarter, which is coming sometime this month. Hopefully, we hope mid-month, like around the 15th. And that'll be the Kickstarter that kickstarts our gaming company, Entertain the Geeky Games, as well as a Kickstarter for releasing our very first game, which is...
Conniving Cooks.
Mm-hmm.
It is a bluffing and deduction game for 2 to 6 players, in which players are cooks in a fancy restaurant trying to get the other cooks fired while also making sure the guests get their food on time.
All right, that's Conniving Cooks. So keep a lookout for information regarding all of that.
Yeah.
And thank you very much for listening to this episode. Sorry for the late release this Saturday. We will be better in the future.
Yep.
All right, thanks for listening.
Thank you.